This is a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Health and Living with me, Ti Xiao Ik. Now, child sexual abuse and exploitation has made the headlines again. We just heard in the news bulletin earlier that a 24-year-old man was arrested when he was found in possession of child sexual abuse materials. There have been other recent news reports about pornographic and sexual abuse materials exploiting children that has been found to be rife on Malaysian registered IP addresses. There have also been allegations of sexual harassment by a school motivational speaker. So all these instances show that sexual violence against children can happen under our very own noses, and that we do need to do more to protect children on all fronts, at home, in school, in many social settings, as well as online. So joining me for her monthly show today, Dr. Rajini Saravanandan, consultant developmental pediatrician, to discuss this, along with Tulasi Munasamy, Advocacy and Partnerships Director from Protect and Save the Children. We'll be discussing the risk of abuse and exploitation that children face. Where are these risks present? How, parents, teachers, caregivers, and children themselves need to know how to have conversations about protecting themselves, about the risks, about consent, and really just break the silence around sexual violence. So call us if you have thoughts or questions you'd like to share. The number to call is 03-7733-2900. You can also WhatsApp 018-789-8899. Dr. Rajini and Tulasi, thank you so much for joining me today. Tulasi, I'd like to start with if you could weigh in first to help us understand the different forms of sexual violence against children, so that if anybody has misconceptions or are limited by a very narrow view, we understand the landscape of the risks that children face. Could you, Tulasi, weigh in on that first?
Thank you, Cheryl, and thanks, Dr. Rajini. So in terms of violence against, sexual violence against children, right, it kind of falls under the broad context of violence against children. So we have the Convention on the Rights of the Child, and the CRC basically defines sexual abuse and exploitation as the coercion or forcing a child to engage in any unlawful or psychologically harmful sexual activity. It also talks about the use of children in commercial sexual exploitation. Also covers child sexual exploitation in travel and tourism, including children being forced, coerced, trafficked into sex work or prostitution, forcing children into making audio or visual images of child sexual abuse or exposing them to it. And they could be trafficked into Malaysia to do all of the stuff. Or they're sold to anyone who's looking to buy a child for sexual purposes. And this can happen online or offline. It could be at the direction of any other person engaging in sexual activity in exchange of anything that is of value to them, you know. For example, in exchange for food, exchange for shelter or drugs or protection from any person. So, and really it depends on the specific circumstances. It can happen in the internet. It can happen through child marriages, early marriages, forced marriages. You know, it can happen in venues where children are performing at these venues, sexual activities are being performed at these venues. And many children experience sexual victimization, which is also not accompanied by physical force or restraint. But it's still negatively impactful to their cognitive, to their social emotional behavior. So it's, you know, a range of what would I call it, risk of sexual abuse and exploitation that is covered under violence against children.
Dr. Rajini, Tulasi has already set that stage and clearly outlined so many different situations and risks. And we, I guess we know instinctively, intuitively that children need protection, right? But if you could just further emphasize for us, what is the vulnerable position of children in such situations that would lead them to being at risk? And not just looking at all children homogeneously, but who are some children that you think would be particularly vulnerable?
I think, Shari, I think, you know, Felicity has actually given a wide range of situations where we would consider a child is considered violence against children. Yeah. I think, you know, it's funny because as a medical student, or even as a, when I was first training in pediatrics and we talked about abuse, that list was probably less than a third what it is now. But with social media and all that, we forget that violence against children or maltreatment against children actually can take place online as well without contact. Yeah. And I think what's important to understand in when we talk about not just sexual abuse, but just general maltreatment of children, it's when we have an adult who is really a person who has a position of responsibility or trust. And that adult takes advantage of a child. And here the definition of a child in Malaysia is 18 and below, right? Below 18 years old. So it takes advantage of that child for their own gratification, to satisfy their own needs without taking into account the child's needs. Yeah, I think we can say that that defines abuse or maltreatment. And so if you think about groups of people or children, I should say, who are vulnerable, of course, you know, working with children with different needs, I will say children with disabilities or different abilities or different needs are probably going to be top of that list for me. But then you also have children who are vulnerable because they come from poverty, yeah, when there's economic deprivation, because there's a lot more stress in that family. And then there's also the group that maybe Tulsi has been involved with, and that's, you know, undocumented children or migrants. And I think this is, these probably are the three main groups that I would say are vulnerable. That's not to say that, you know, children who come from the T20 group or the M40 group are not vulnerable. I think we cannot forget them. But when there's these three, I would say these are the three biggest groups. I think with COVID-19, we will see a lot more children being pushed into that group, which are under a lot of economic stress. And also, when we talk about economic stress, a lot of the children in that group also come from single-parent families. So,
Yes, Tulsi, would you like to add to that?
Yeah, no, Dr. Rajini, thank you so much for covering those vulnerable groups of children. Just very quickly to add, they're also refugee and asylum-seeking children in this country, and you know they're completely at risk. And you have our stateless children, undocumented. You've also got unaccompanied, separated children, you know, without parental care, and they're even more at risk of child sexual exploitation abuse, only because they don't have documentation or they're perceived as illegal in Malaysia, and you know, they're not recognized by citizens in this country, like the stateless children, for example. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, so the support systems that should be in place to protect them structurally and institutionally, they may be excluded from those, they may fall through the caps. Tulsi, I think the news bulletin that I referred to earlier, which talked about a 24-year-old man in Seremban who has just been arrested, it reported that he used social media to communicate with the children who were actually overseas. So we can see how geographical borders also don't matter anymore, right? Can you give some insights into the kinds of platforms that children risk being exploited and abused?
If so, recently PSC ran an online child protection workshop with children and adolescents, and we found that, and some of these platforms even I didn't know, you know, were so technologically behind. And some of the platforms they shared were TikTok, there was Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, YouTube, Discord, WhatsApp. I mean, WhatsApp is quite common, right? And then there was WeChat, Pinterest, Messenger, Telegram, all these different gaming platforms I had completely clueless about. And then there was also, you know, other platforms like your Netflix, your Prime, you know, where you're watching videos and shows and series. So they shared that they use platforms to socialize, you know, post updates about themselves, post photos, share stories, make friends, etc. You know, play online games and all. But they also shared that, you know, they, well, not all of them shared, but there were some of them who shared that, you know, strangers would also come to them and speak to them. And, you know, and if at all they are particularly feeling low that day, you know, they would reveal more about themselves through these different social media insights or platforms. And, you know, it's easy, right, for the perpetrators to target them because they're looming in this dark web and they can easily take advantage of these children, these vulnerable children who, if they have no information about, you know, legislation or reporting lines or the fact that, you know, their rights are being violated, or no information about sexual and reproductive health, or no information about sexuality rights, you know, they can easily be susceptible to child sexual abuse and exploitation. And so this perpetrator, so this is what I call the grooming, you know, so they can easily nurture that emotional connection, especially if you're vulnerable, you know, you don't come from a stable family. But having said that, even the stable family ones, you can easily still be a target, especially if you lack that awareness about your own rights. And then they disclose about themselves. They disclose the images about themselves. And you know, and the perpetrators then make use of that, right? They make sure that you have to maintain it as a secret. You cannot share with anyone. They make threats. And so it goes on and becomes offline after that. Yeah, so these were some of the revelations that we discovered during our online child protection workshop.
And this came from young people themselves?
This came from children and young people themselves in Malaysia, including your migrant refugee community, you know, and also your children who live in the urban community as well. So combination.
Mm. Very insightful, because we need to know. And I mean, I've been told Facebook is not even a place where young people are on. So like you said, and exactly like you, Tulasi, I'm also pretty clueless about the different platforms and channels that young people are engaging in. But clearly the predators are very clued in, and that's where they are going. Let's continue this conversation after the break. I'm speaking to Dr. Rajini Sarvanandan, consultant developmental pediatrician, and Tulasi Munisamy, advocacy and partnerships director at Protect and Save the Children, about sexual abuse and exploitation of children, what we need to do to protect children and to equip, empower children themselves with the knowledge and awareness to protect themselves. Call us if you have any thoughts or questions, 03-7733-2900 or WhatsApp 018-789-8899. We'll be right back on BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Shao-Ik. My guests today are Dr. Rajini Sarvanandan, Consultant Developmental Pediatrician, and Tulasi Munisamy, Advocacy and Partnerships Director from Protect and Save the Children. We're discussing how to prevent sexual abuse and exploitation of children today. Do call us if you have any thoughts or questions, 03-7733-2900 or WhatsApp 018-789-8899. Dr. Rajini, we've talked about the risks and the circumstances in which children could be abused, maltreated, and exploited. Now, I want to try to understand how we can look at children's ability to assess their own risk, to the level of development and maturity that's needed. Because, you know, Tulasi has explained that there's a lot of coercion involved, subtle threats or overt threats, a lot of grooming involved in exploiting and abusing children. And just because there is a quote-unquote reward that children get in return, and they therefore assent to whatever act it is, it doesn't mean that it's consent. So, you know, perhaps actually I'll ask Tulasi first before I go to you, Dr. Rajini. Tulasi, what is even the legal age of sexual consent for children in Malaysia?
Yeah, so the legal age of sexual consent in Malaysia is 16. Okay, and it means that actually, if you read it, it says girls. So it means that the girls in this age are supposedly having this age and maturity legally to understand sex and consent. Okay, so those who are below 16 years old, if you're 15 and younger, cannot give consent, even though they may think that, you know, they have given consent or assent, and therefore, you know, they can have sex. But it's then identified as statutory rape. So I think with the child rights advocates in the child protection world, we want to advocate, or we are advocating, for the age, the legal age of sexual consent to be raised to 18 and above, preferably 21, where the young adult is of legal age to give consent, has the knowledge, has the experience, has the maturity, has understanding to legally give consent, because they fully understand what they're giving consent to.
And how do they fully understand what they're giving consent to, Dr. Rajini? What kind of maturity would we expect children to even have to, you know, these, there's so many nuances in this.
So I'm going to be cynical and say that that 16-year-old age was made out of convenience by probably a man, right, to justify child marriages. But, okay, that's a different topic altogether. But that's a good question. And you know, why is it that it's 16 for girls specifically and not for boys, right? I mean, where's the gender equality in that? But, and this is a difficult question, Shaui, because there's no clear-cut age, right? I mean, when we talk about consent, first of all, a child needs to understand what his or her rights are. And if we look at how we parent our children in the traditional Asian way, is that you listen to what I have to say. I am the adult in this situation, and you are the child, and you are just supposed to follow and not sort of, you know, answer back, etc. Right? And even, and to some extent, it's always been accepted as the norm that when girls are talked about in a very sexual negative way. Okay. And we had a recent case, right, where a teacher talked about, we all know the case, Ayn, and how the teacher talked about, you know, if you're choosing to rape somebody, this is who you should rape. In those sort of jokes. And the fact that adults can talk that way tells you that you could question whether any of our children are actually understand what their rights are, because a lot of this has been said in classrooms, but children have been scared to stand up to it. So in a sense, if a child doesn't know what his or her right is, then they are going to be vulnerable, and they're not going to be mature enough to make those decisions, because they have this perception that the adult is right and I just have to give in, right? So that's if you look at it generally. Every child's going to be different according to how they have been parented, whether they have biological parents or no biological parent, or by the adults around them. And this is where I think it's going to be hard to say who is actually mature. In medicine, we have something called Gillick competence, right? Where a young adult is allowed to make choices about things. So the Gillick competence came about when we talk about contraception and whether a teenager is able to make that decision to opt for contraception, etc. And there's no specific age, but we look and try to understand what a child understands in terms of what is right and wrong from their perception to some extent. Mm. When you deal with children with different needs, special needs, it's going to be different. And so we look at understanding level as well as what norms they have been exposed to as well.
But the short answer would be 16 is still too young, right?
If you ask me, yes, definitely. I mean, why is it that we set a limit for alcohol at a higher age, but when it comes to consent for sexual intercourse, it's at 16. Mm.
I also want to share a comment from a listener, Paul, who said that consent is a legal issue, but understanding consequences is something else. Consequences last a lifetime. They even transgress generations and sadly becomes acceptable. And there are cultural modes that accommodate and reinforce this despicability. Very strong words, but, his message definitely comes through there. Tulasi, from your work, whether it's with PSC or even your previous work, what have you seen to be the impact of all these various types of sexual violence against children?
So I think just based from my case management experience, when they're sexually abused and exploited, this is girls and boys, right? They can face a variety of negative implications. They can be tortured. They can be pregnant. So they experience teenage pregnancies. They experience STI, sexually transmitted diseases, illnesses. They can also go and, have illegal abortions done. I know legally in Malaysia, you're not supposed to do, but there are places where you can get this done, just from my case management experience. And children also endure sexual violence or child marriage in exchange for freedom from their agents or debt bondage situation. They experience prostitution, sexual slavery, HIV and AIDS, and mental health issues, and also their developmental and identity needs are also negatively impacted. And this is generally from my case management experience, but the most marginalized children from marginalized communities, that impact is even far greater, especially so when they're unable to access protection and support services. So, the risk continues, that abuse and exploitation continues, and especially when they're unable to get the protection and support system, support services that they need. Over to you.
Dr. Rajini, from a developmental perspective, and we've talked about how early adverse experiences affect children's mental and developmental issues, and it could be lifelong, right?
Yeah, and we know that if we know that abuse children often enable abuse in the next generation. They may not be the abusers, but they may be the enablers of abuse to their children, yeah, whether it be males or females. And as Paul mentioned, this has an impact across generations if we don't intervene in some way to address this issue. You know, that impact is not just in terms of perpetrating abuse, but also the impact on the physical health of those who have been abused in children. We know there's a higher risk of physical diseases, non-communicable diseases, mental health issues right through their life course. We know that there is also an impact on their education and their ability to hold down jobs, etc. So there's an economic effect in the longer term. And then there's the risk of addiction. So we know there's a higher risk of alcohol, drug, especially alcohol and drug abuse amongst children who have been abused as well.
Mm. So Paul has followed up to say we as therapists are fighting fires, and what he is really interested to know is how can we prevent or reduce these statistics. So let's look a little bit at that prevention of abuse and exploitation, that awareness and knowledge and information that you talked about, Tulasi. How do you see us approaching this?
I think it's really important that we speak about comprehensive sexuality education in Malaysia. I cannot stress how important it is that we educate our children and adolescents, parents, caregivers, teachers, actually everyone on comprehensive sexuality education. Obviously, there's a lot of taboo in talking about CSE, comprehensive sexuality education. But when you don't talk about it, right, these children or adolescents are more susceptible to child sexual exploitation and abuse. I mean, it can lead to teenage pregnancies, you know, your baby dumping, your illegal abortions, like what we covered earlier. And you know, just from my case management experience, also in my interactions with my friends, you know, I observed that when parents or caregivers don't speak to their children about sex, right, sexuality and reproductive health, when they are monitored minimally and you know they lack that kind of parental supervision, then they face greater risk of being sexually abused and exploited offline and online. And so the conversations that we need to have has to be normalized with them. I mean, they should be able to feel safe and comfortable. They should trust us enough to come and tell us what's happening to them. You know, what kind of risks are they facing? What kind of experiences are they facing? And we should be able to have that correct information and tell them in a way that they understand. Not in a scientific way. Scientific way is great, but in a way that they understand, so they don't go and look for information outside that could be incorrect. And you know, there are so many resources out there on comprehensive sexuality education. We all need to kind of remove that biasness, that shame and stigma that we have this conversation, normalize these conversations with the children and adolescents so that they can protect themselves, but we can also protect them in the best way possible. Mm. Just very quickly, I want to say that, you know, at PSC, we have our signature program called Keep Me Safe. And we cover a range of topics, you know, in terms of bodily autonomy, in terms of, you know, how can they recognize the risk when they are harmed or at risk of it, you know, when they're experiencing sexual abuse or exploitation. We cover safe and unsafe touch, safe and unsafe secrets, also very important, happens all the time with grooming. And then teaching them about puberty, respecting boundaries, respecting relationships, and not only giving that information, but also giving them that skills, empowering them so that they have that skills and confidence to say no when they feel unsafe or when they feel like, you know, okay, this is a risky situation. What do I do? My alerts are up. Okay, I have to go and run and tell somebody I have to. Or maybe I know this reporting platforms and helplines, I can already report, you know, what's happening to me. And it has to, the sessions, right, it has to be done in a very facilitated manner, not lecture style. It has to be fun. It has to be participatory, has to be inclusive, and also rendered in a very age and gender appropriate manner.
You know, at the end of the day, it means that the facilitators, the teachers, and parents themselves also are the ones who need to know how to have these conversations. So let's come back and explore that a little bit more. Dr. Rajini knows that question is coming to her, right? Like, how do parents have these conversations? It does begin at home, I think. But let's go for a quick break first. I'm speaking to Dr. Rajini Saravanandan, consultant developmental pediatrician, and Tulasi Munisamy, advocacy and partnerships director at Protect and Save the Children. Do call us if you have questions or thoughts. 03-7733-2900. You can also WhatsApp 018-789-8899. We'll be right back on Health and Living, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Shaoik, and my guests, Dr. Rajini Saravanandan, consultant developmental pediatrician, and Tulasi Munisamy, advocacy and partnerships director at Protect and Save the Children. We're discussing prevention of sexual abuse and exploitation against children, you know, on the back of recent news. All kinds of different instances of children and young people being abused and exploited, either online or, you know, offline, so to speak, in schools, places where they're supposed to be safe and protected. If you have thoughts or questions you'd like to share with us, you can either call us at 03-7733-2900 or you can WhatsApp 018-789-8899. Tulasi earlier shared this incredible, what sounds like really, really rich content that Protect and Save the Children has developed to facilitate conversations, interesting and engaging conversations with children and young people about related to sexuality education, how to know their bodies, how to protect themselves, safe and unsafe touch, safe and unsafe secrets. That's so amazing, Tulasi. But I guess while we are pondering on questions like, why isn't CSE really well adapted in our curriculum and questions like that, let's also think about what we can start to do at home. So in the family setting, Dr. Rajini, how do we have these conversations? And not just the birds and the bees, the biology type of conversations, right? But talking about it in a way that's actually relevant to children's lives.
Yeah, I think, you know, first thing is to stress that I think we often turn to other people when it comes to difficult conversations. But actually, we look at evidence. Yeah, we talk about research evidence. A number of programs have been developed in different parts of the world about, you know, to see what works. And actually, if you look at evidence, and what it shows is actually by empowering parents to talk to their children about these uncomfortable, and I'm putting it in inverted commas, topics, that actually by empowering parents to do the parenting for such topics, it actually has an impact on children much more than rolling out programs in schools, etc., on a mass basis or in a lecture style, as Tulasi mentioned earlier. So what's, if you look back, for example, at back in, I think it was the early 2000s, around 2010, there was a program that was rolled out in Africa where it's like a parenting program. And I think it's called Family Matters. And it was carried out in America, as well as later on that program was rolled out in a community in Africa. As we know, a lot higher rates of sexual violence, HIV transmission, STDs in that community. And the aim was to empower mothers to talk to their children about protecting themselves. And it was actually very successful because in that community, rates of HIV, young pregnancy, sexual violence actually reduced. Now, obviously, I'm not saying that program needs to be rolled out here, but what a lot of evidence is showing is that one, parents are important. Another one, programs that involve peers. So as Tulsi mentioned earlier, you know, they did a workshop where they had young people coming up and talking about their experiences as well. Because as we know, young people, especially teens and adolescents, they relate better to their peers. So I think those are two things to look at. Yeah. And you know me, Shaoyi, we've talked about this a few times. When should it start? And people are always uncomfortable when I say that it actually should start in the preschool years. It actually should start when you're bathing your child and you're teaching them body parts, like the eyes, the nose, the hands, the toes, the fingers, that we should be talking to them about their body parts and not using words that
euphemisms.
Yes. So the normal, you know, your little birdie or your pet or things like that. Yes, you can. You can, but when it's young children, you want them to know what this body part is. You want them to know that, you know, who can touch them where. And so that happens from a very young age when you already restrict who can bath your child, who can touch your child, who can change your child, etc. And you lay down those rules from a very young age. And then you start to talk to them about what is appropriate behavior, what is inappropriate behavior, about privacy, about the fact that, you know, they shouldn't be running out of the room without their clothes on, or, you know, covering themselves, etc. And then talking about safety, who can touch them, where can people touch them, and where can they touch people and how they can touch people as well. So all those conversations need to start from a very young age. And then we talk about, you know, the birds and the bees as well, because that's part of that conversation. And there's a lot of material out there now that has been produced that is age appropriate. And I'm not just talking about books. I've even seen them as, you know, online videos now. Of course, we want to choose the ones that are appropriate. And I think we all know about the controversy of the videos that were produced by one of our government departments early on. We don't want those sort of videos. We want videos that are relatable to children. And I think this is where parents and early childhood educators matter, because we know if things are reinforced in different settings, that it makes more sense to children.
Yeah. And I wonder whether there is a misconception that parents think this is a one-off conversation I need to have at some point, and we've closed the chapter on that, right? And how do we look at actually the need to refresh this, especially as they enter teenage years and start to have different kinds of social interactions?
Yeah, I think if you start to have those conversations early, it actually shows children that they can then have conversations with you. And, you know, we always talk about open communication. And I think sometimes headline news can also be useful to, you know, illustrate things to children as they get older. Yeah. You know, a lot of times headline news, most people don't get newspapers, but you also see it in online news portals. You can see it in social media and, you know, like that recent case of the 24-year-old man. Mm-hmm. Actually, be surprised the number of teens who actually know about it as well.
Tulasi, we have a question here on WhatsApp. Not sure if you do have the statistics on hand. Manisha wants to know if there are statistics of perpetrators of sexual violence against children being parents and relatives. Let's start with that first, perhaps.
Say that data is very scarce in Malaysia on child sexual exploitation and abuse cases. I think what I found was, JKM and police revealed last year that, the cases on child sexual exploitation and abuse cases, it was increasing. And then obviously with the recent Shadows Index report, it talks about how countries are doing in terms of prevention response to child sexual exploitation abuse. Malaysia ranked 23rd out of 60. And then recently, there was also the Ministry of Women that also demonstrated or told us that, there's some, 1,000 over child abuse cases recorded from January to June. And of that, some 39% were child sexual abuse cases, but they don't talk about whether or not the perpetrators are parents or caregivers or trusted adults. But from my case management experience, I will tell you that it can be anyone. It could be a parent, it could be a caregiver, it could be your neighbor, it could be your uncle, it could be a teacher, it could be a complete stranger that you're meeting online. It could be your friend. Could be the mama person who you regularly go to. Could be your bus driver. Anyone could be a perpetrator. So I think in terms of data in Malaysia, this is an area that, our child advocacy kind of groups have been advocating for better evidence-based kind of programs and just better collection of data and having that stats available for, effective program and advocacy work. I think we really need to, because then it lends credibility for our work, but also shows what are the gaps and areas that we need to improve.
And Manisha also just wanted to share that the Asian style of authoritarian parenting prevents children from speaking up. Just very quickly, Tulasi, from the workshop that you ran recently, did the young people and children themselves express that they found it difficult to talk to their adults about any of these kinds of issues?
Yes, they did. I think most often than not, the Asian style of parenting is, I tell you, you do as I say. I also grew up in that kind of household. I mean, many of my friends grew up in that kind of household. So in terms of having, a different style of parenting that facilitates open conversation, I think we really need that, especially if you want to talk about comprehensive, sexuality education with your children. You want to talk about sex, you want to talk about sexuality rights, you want to talk about gender, you want to talk about consent. Like, you want to have conversations with your children, and the children want to have conversations with you, but they can only do so if it's facilitated in a safe, comfortable, trusting environment, right, where they can come and tell you what's happening to them. They have all these questions. Mommy, daddy, like, can you talk to me about it? Or, I had this experience at school. They can come and tell you these things. But if you are growing up in a typically, environment where I've grown up, very authoritarian, I tell you, okay, you have to do this, and I'm not going to share what's happened to me at school, or if somebody has, perpetrated violence on me, I'm not going to share, and I'll keep it within myself, and, probably write in my journal, maybe share with my closest friends, and then that abuse will continue because I wouldn't know where to go and seek help,
So that safe, non-judgmental kind of environment is what we need to nurture. Something you've talked about many times as well, Dr. Rajini. Unfortunately, we have to wrap up, but perhaps this is a good point to share some takeaway thoughts in terms of if we're parents are listening, teachers themselves, caregivers, where do we start? Some final thoughts again to just wrap it up. Tulasi?
Comprehensive childcare education is very important too. I want to say in Malaysia, we have the Sexual Offences Against Children Act. Okay, so we are all of us are mandated to report to the competent authorities on suspected. That means the moment you suspect child sexual exploitation and abuse cases, we already need to report. And our legislation on Child Act, on the Sexual Offences Against Children Act, these are all needing to be better reflecting the prevention, risk mitigation response on child sexual exploitation abuse, online and offline. But most importantly, very important for everyone to know the types of child sexual abuse and exploitation, comprehensive sexuality education, where to go and report, how to identify, how to recognize the signs of it, and where to seek help. And including children and adolescents, they all need to be educated. Thank you.
Dr. Rajini, any final thoughts?
Yeah, I think Tulsi summed up that part. I'm going to say, as communities, we can do a lot to protect our children, starting from home, creating those safe spaces for children to open up and have these discussions. And also, if we as parents feel that we are ill-equipped, there are programs that are run by NGOs like Protect and Save the Children that really help facilitate parents to be able to have these conversations. And we should maybe be thinking about, you know, reaching out to such programs as well.
Mm. So Protect and Save the Children, right there with the content that they have developed. And thank you so much for having this discussion with me today. Tulsi Munisamy, Advocacy and Partnerships Director from Protect and Save the Children, as well as Dr. Rajini Sarvanandan, Consultant Developmental Pediatrician. This has been Health and Living, BFM 89.9.
You have been listening to a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station. For more stories of the same kind, download the BFM app.